Well, thanks so much, Anthony, and thank you everyone for being here. It is wonderful to be here in Adelaide and to be able to speak to the AI group in person. That was not guaranteed flying in from Sydney yesterday, but I made it. So really glad to be here. It truly has been an extraordinary time since we last came together in Geelong with the Victorian branch back in 2019. Now, some of you may not know, but the title of my speech that time back in 2019 was Lumps, Bumps and Waves. And since then, we really have taken our lumps. We've seen an enormous bump and we've come to dread additional waves. The human, social and economic costs of this pandemic have been huge. The outcomes have diverged wildly from expectations. And there really was no rule book for understanding how the pandemic would play out. The possibility of a pandemic was certainly contemplated by governments, and the relevant policymakers did formulate scenarios and plans in case one emerged. But things didn't turn out like those scenarios and plans. The epidemiology of the virus that causes COVID-19 is quite different from the avian flu viruses that we usually assumed to be the relevant pathogen. And the public health response was also very different. Perhaps the starkest example of things not turning out as pre-pandemic scenarios envisaged was the rapid development of effective vaccines, and not only one, but several. There have been plenty of movies about pandemics, but the rollout of multiple vaccines within a year generally hasn't featured in the final act. I doubt any studio would have bought such a script. You know, plot twist, Dolly Parton helped fund the Moderna vaccine. Who would have bought that script? Nobody would have bought that script, even if they wanted a vehicle for Dolly Parton. Suffice to say that forecasting in this environment is inevitably an exercise in humility. Even before the rollout of vaccines, Australia's recovery exceeded all expectations. Employment and output are already above their pre-pandemic levels. Unemployment has returned to its pre-pandemic levels. And as the Governor outlined last week, New Zealand is the only other advanced economy with employment above its end 2019 level. Only a handful of economies, most of them in the Asian region, have seen GDP recover to pre-pandemic levels. Both on the health and economic fronts, Australia has faced up to the enormous challenge posed by the pandemic. And as a nation, we've largely been up to that task. Now, much of the unexpected strength of the recovery stems from Australia's relatively good health outcomes. Good control of the virus allowed a rapid and near-complete opening of the domestic economy. The recent short lockdowns and other restrictions haven't been as disruptive for the economy as the earlier longer ones. And I did make it. And while the border closure has posed challenges in some parts of the economy, so far it hasn't materially impeded that recovery. Now, policy support has also been key to this positive surprise. Additional monetary and fiscal policy support over the course of the past year, beyond the initial responses, boosted the outlook beyond what was originally envisaged. Now, different economies have had different, very different experiences as the pandemic has evolved. But there are three common themes that have emerged and from which we can draw lessons. In a big shift, people adapt. When the crisis is over, people bounce back. And when policy supports, people respond. Turning to the first of these lessons, throughout the history of our species, humans have adapted to many different environments and a range of challenges. When circumstances change, we do adapt. And we can see this adaptability in the economic response to subsequent waves of the pandemic. Even though lockdowns were in many cases at least as stringent as the first time around, the drag on activity was usually smaller. This was the pattern in the Victoria's second lockdown, and even more starkly in the winter lockdowns in the Northern Hemisphere winter late last year and early this year. Conditioned to the extreme effects of the lockdowns in March and April of last year, many forecasters, including us, overestimated how damaging the subsequent ones would be. Output did decline in many advanced economies in the December quarter of last year or the March quarter of this year. But in almost all cases, the outcome was not as bad as forecasters expected. Almost all of the forecasting surprises over that period are to the right-hand side of the zero line in this graph. Now, one way people adapted was finding ways to operate effectively while in lockdown. Now, I'm sure you all remember the rush in March to get everyone working from home who could work from home. Now, not all firms and not all workers could do this because of the nature of their work. Of those that could, some firms were already well prepared for flexible working. But for many, it was a huge shift. Over time, though, people adapted. For some, working from home has been a struggle. But most businesses we speak to as part of our liaison program report that when they made the switch, their operations continued reasonably effectively. A small number of firms even report the productivity rose. Other firms adapted in how they dealt with their suppliers and customers. Existing trends towards greater use of e-commerce and home delivery were greatly accelerated. Another way people adapted was shifting the pattern of demand. Around the world, restrictions on activity constrained services industries in particular. So consumer spending shifted away from services to goods, and the Australian data clearly show this. This went beyond the obvious substitutions, such as from restaurant meals to groceries to cook at home. Sports equipment substituted for closed gyms, toys and games for organised children's activities. And with more time at home, people renovated, redecorated and kitted out their home offices. Now, this switch in spending was a global phenomenon and it supported a swift recovery in global trade. Goods trade is now above pre-pandemic levels. Strong demand for manufactured goods has been a positive for economies with large export sectors, including China and some economies in East Asia. It's also increased demand for many commodities, as well as for other components such as semiconductors. This has boosted prices in many cases. Overall, these price rises have tended to add to incomes in Australia. The ratio of the prices of things we export to those of things we import, which is known as the terms of trade, is approaching the peak that reached a decade ago, which itself was an 150-year high. Our species' inherent adaptability doesn't mean that all adjustments are smooth, though. This shift in demand has contributed to bottlenecks and delays throughout global supply chains. Our liaison contacts and others in the business community have certainly seen the effects of this. Shipping costs are up sharply, and so are some other costs. It's hard to know how long these disruptions will last. Many countries are still contending with outbreaks that are constraining output. In others, exporters are trying to catch up on backlogs of past orders, as well as deal with high levels of new orders. But it is reasonable to expect that these disruptions will ease over time as bottlenecks are dealt with and health-related constraints on production ease. Some key producers also plan to expand capacity, for example, in semiconductors and ships. So the effect on prices should dissipate over time. A second lesson relates to the recovery phase. When the crisis is over, people bounce back. Australia's been one of the early examples, given our relatively good outcomes on controlling the virus. Our experience may point to possible outcomes for others as they emerge from their larger waves of the pandemic. Our experience is that once the virus comes under better control and the restrictions on activity are lifted, activity bounces back very quickly. Activity declined during lockdowns and other periods of restrictions because that was mandated. It was not primarily because demand was very weak. So long as incomes were maintained in this period, people reverted to spending levels that were very close to pre-pandemic levels as soon as it was permitted to do so. Now, perhaps that should have been less of a surprise. People like doing the things that were necessarily restricted by public health measures, whether that's visiting family or friends or going to a restaurant or even, for some people at least, going to the gym. The result is a sharp recovery in output and employment, far sharper than many of us would have imagined, many of us would dare imagine a year ago. This is very different from the pattern of past downturns. Those events weakened private sector balance sheets. It was, often triggered by financial system issues. And so that weighed on confidence and the demand, and it weighed on demand for a very extended period. And as a result, the recoveries were drawn out. There was a time last year when we worried that the uncertainty around the course of the pandemic would dampen demand in a similar way, and again, slowing that recovery phase. But fortunately, it doesn't seem to have turned out that way. So the large, swift contraction of mid-2020 has been reversed by a similarly swift recovery. And we see the same pattern in subsequent lockdowns as well. Spending declines when they're in force, but the recovery is rapid. And the timely data we have on spending suggests that the snapback after the shorter lockdowns we've had this year, imposed in various parts of Australia this year, has been almost immediate. The big question for the outlook is whether recovery is simply a snapback to the prior patterns of activity, or whether there's some makeup for the lost growth. This is, in fact, the same question I addressed in that 2019 speech in Geelong. When you hit an economic bump, whether it's a flood, a cyclone, or a lockdown to control a pandemic, do you just return to normal and the production that didn't occur during the bump is lost forever? Or is there a period of catch-up where spending is higher than normal for a while? Well, the answer is shaping up to be that it depends. It depends on which category of spending we're talking about. There are some categories of spending where catch-up is feasible. Most of these are durable goods where the timing of purchases can shift around. So we've certainly seen that for vehicle sales. But most of the categories of spending that were most affected by the restrictions on activity were inevitably, given the epidemiology of the pandemic, they were services, especially in-person services. And it is much harder, if not impossible, to catch up here. I mean, if you weren't able to get a haircut for a few months, you don't get two haircuts to make up for it. One will suffice. And, you know, there are quite a few people who stopped dyeing their hair after, now that they've, you know, the transition while no one was, you know, able to see you is possible. And while some hospitality and travel spending might see some catch up as we finally catch up with all the friends and family we've only been able to see on a screen, there are limits to that. The third lesson relates to one of the key reasons why this time we did get a V-shaped recovery. When policy supports, people respond. Support from the various arms of policy helped to sustain economies through the period of lockdowns, smooth the shock, and speed up the recoveries. Now, the use of wage subsidies to preserve employment has been a feature of labour markets in some advanced economies for many years. But these programs were used much more widely in response to the pandemic than they had been in past downturns. And several economies, including New Zealand and here in Australia, adopted them for the first time. And the share of the workforce covered by these schemes has generally been higher than was seen in previous downturns. So that's a really big shift. Now, the benefit of these schemes is that in preserving the employee-employer relationship, and it's really clear, in countries that did not use these schemes, such as the United States, most of the adjustment to lockdown took the form of people losing their jobs. Unemployment spiked up dramatically. And though it came down quickly, employment is still well below pre-pandemic levels there. By contrast, in Europe and Japan, almost all the adjustment has been in average hours worked. Far fewer people actually lost their jobs, and unemployment rates increased by much less. So policy support really matters. Australia's initial experience was somewhere in the middle of these two extremes. Not all workers were eligible for JobKeeper, and for some organisations, especially those affected by border closures, keeping staff on might have been seen as postponing the inevitable. But the JobKeeper program clearly supported the recovery in the labour market. And the income provided by JobKeeper was an important part of the Australian fiscal policy response more generally. Around the world, governments responded to the economies needed for support. Their scope to provide that support has varied according to individual country circumstances. But in the main, advanced economies in particular have provided more support than was the case in other downturns over recent decades. And there's perhaps no better indication of the scale of the support than the paths of household and business incomes during this period. At a time when economic activity contracted more and faster than at any time since the Great Depression in the 1930s, household disposable income actually increased. Now, this is not the usual pattern in a downturn, to say the least. Profits also increased, partly because JobKeeper covered more of many firms' costs than their revenues declined, and partly because other tax and business support measures improved their post-tax incomes. Rent and loan repayment deferrals helped as well. Now, some individual households and businesses are facing tough times. But taking each sector as a whole, though, both the household sector and the business sector are entering the expansion phase with stronger balance sheets than they had before the pandemic. This is an exceptional and welcome outcome. And again, policy support clearly affects people's responses. Whether it's the consumer spending response to higher incomes, the response of residential construction activity to the Home Builder Program and state-based measures, or the response of machinery and equipment to various tax incentives, policy support has worked. Monetary support, policy support has played a role in supporting the economy too. Now, others have discussed the detail of the bank's policy measures recently, so I won't repeat that much of that information today. There's been sort of two main waves of that support. In March of last year, the board cut the cash rate to 0.5% and later that month made a further reduction to 0.25%. And that was part of a larger package of policy measures. Financial markets were quite dislocated at that time, so the bank used its existing market operations to provide liquidity to the market and address that dislocation. And as part of that March package, the board introduced several new policy measures. It set a target for the three-year government bond yield and provided low-cost funding to the banking system, also with a three-year term, which we call the Term Funding Facility, or TFF. The TFF was structured to encourage lending to businesses and especially to small and medium-sized firms. And the initial tranche of that funding was available to be drawn down at the end of October. So in September, the board decided to add another tranche of funding as part of the Term Funding Facility, and that's available to be drawn down till the end of this month. And so most of that has already been drawn down. So taking both of those tranches together, the TFF has made available more than $200 billion of low-cost funding to support the provision of credit to the economy and thus support the broader recovery. Then in November of last year, the board decided on a further package of measures. It reduced the cash rate, the yield target and the cost of the TFF to 0.1%, and it introduced a program to purchase in the secondary market bonds issued by Australian and state and territory governments. And the initial announcement was for the purchase of $100 billion of bonds over the following 6 months, and then a further $100 billion tranche of bond purchases was announced in February this year. And these measures have all contributed to maintaining highly expansionary monetary conditions, and in this way, they've helped lower funding costs and borrowing costs, supported the provision of credit, and kept the exchange rate lower than it otherwise would have been. And again, people have responded to that support, especially in the housing market, but also in some aspects of business activity. Now, a once-in-a-century pandemic might lead you to think that things will never be the same again. And yet so many of us yearn to return to what we used to think of as normal. So in the remainder of my talk, I'd like to discuss some of the things we've learned, mostly from our discussions with liaison contacts, about which of the effects of the pandemic may be lasting. Now, if this pandemic had happened a decade or more ago, I think the response would have been very different. It was to be expected that many businesses had to shut entirely while others continued to work on site. But the advent of faster home internet and video conferencing enabled many white-collar workers to continue working, but from home. And the question of whether this shift is here to stay is clearly one of intense community interest. And on this question, one size does not fit all. Some people have loved working from home. Others have itched to get back to the office. And others have appreciated a mix of both. Different firms have taken different approaches. Some work can only be done in person. I mean, there are industries such as hospitality and construction where you have, you know, no scope to introduce remote working. Some other kinds of work run smoother with at least some in-person contact. I mean, there's nothing like face-to-face interaction for building trust, strengthening relationships, or reinforcing culture. The Australian Bureau of Statistics survey suggests that larger firms are more likely to have staff working remotely than smaller firms. The share of businesses with remote working arrangements increased a lot following the onset of the pandemic. And while some firms have already ceased these arrangements, most have retained them and plan to stick with the current pattern in future. And so this is a lasting effect on the way we work. A sizable minority of firms plan to reduce the amount of remote working at their firms over the longer term, but few will eliminate remote work completely. With more people working remotely, the need for as much office space comes into question, just as the need for retail space does as more shopping goes online. Certainly, vacancy rates for both office and retail property have jumped up since the pandemic began. Occupancy of the space that is still leased is also below pre-pandemic norms. What this means for the longer term has been a constant discussion, both in our liaison program and globally. The general theme that comes out of these discussions is one of uncertainty. While the direction is towards reduced demand for office space, it's too soon to decide how far to cut down on space. A desire for greater space per worker, for social distancing reasons, might partly offset the reduction in space required when more people are working from home. And then the supply response, if there is one, will take a while to come through. Much of the new supply in the next few years was already away before the pandemic. That said, many planned projects have been put on hold and some might end up being cancelled. And if some office or retail property turns out to be surplus to requirement, it will take a while and some creativity before it's repurposed. As I mentioned earlier, adjusting to lockdowns and other restrictions on activity accelerated the existing trends to online commerce and home delivery. Prior to the pandemic, the online share of retail sales was trending up and had reached 7%. And it's currently just under 10%. There was this big shift up last year. And we don't expect this shift will be reversed. Online delivery stretches beyond retail. Many other contacts in our liaison program have indicated that they have increased online services and plan to continue with these services. And this pattern is apparent in a range of industries, whether it's telehealth and online learning, to construction and property development firms using virtual walkthroughs in place of in-person inspections. And although business travel is unlikely to disappear completely, many contacts expect to be more selective about whether in-person meetings are needed. Our own liaison program has also adapted to these new realities in a lasting way. Before the pandemic, almost all our meetings with liaison contacts were in person. Our move to working from home also entailed switching to liaison by phone and video conference. The rapidly changing environment during the peak of the pandemic necessitated more and more frequent discussions with our liaison contacts. And as it turned out, the efficiencies of this change in approach also made that increased tempo possible. More recently, we've scaled back the tempo to something more normal and resumed in-person visits in some cases. But we plan to continue with a mix of in-person and online meetings from now on. Where we have not yet seen large-scale changes in how firms work is in supply networks. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the global pandemic has disrupted production and shipping, including for Australian firms, and we have published some material about that in our statement on monetary policy that came out in May. But this does not seem to have prompted a wholesale rethinking of supply relationships or reshoring. More common has been minor changes to procurement practice, such as ordering supplies earlier to allow for delays. What about the lasting effects on where we live? Well, look, there's nothing like being forced to spend more time at home to make you appreciate or become frustrated with where you live. And the lasting effects of this pandemic on where and how we live will touch all of us directly and indirectly. And they'll have implications for housing construction, urban planning, transport, and the provision of social services and infrastructure. Now, at the same time, we need to be mindful that some of the shifts going on could, in part, be temporary. For example, the border closures have paused immigration, which especially affects Australia's two largest cities. And internal migration from elsewhere in Australia to Melbourne declined during the extended Victorian lockdown last year. Those flows are likely to resume as borders open and restrictions ease, though perhaps at different rates to previous years. Similarly, while many of the people many people moved out of larger population centres to escape the virus or the lockdowns, Some of them might return to their previous locations over time. It's difficult to disentangle these transitory effects from the more lasting ones. There will be at least some cases of people moving further out from the city centre because long commutes will not seem so unpleasant if you only need to do it a couple of days a week. And where full-time working from home is possible, work from home really starts to mean work from anywhere. So for some, it has been possible to move to an entirely different population centre. But these bigger changes are almost certainly going to affect only a minority of the population. Many of us would not leave our existing social networks and support systems lightly. And as I've already mentioned, work from anywhere is not really feasible for everyone. But there will be some shifts, at least at the margin, and that could alter patterns of relative growth. These could matter for patterns of urban expansion and the provision of new infrastructure, even if the distribution of population doesn't shift wholesale. And the pandemic is not over. Australia has seen a swift bounce back, but many other economies are still recovering or contending with outbreaks. During the height of the pandemic, when restrictions on activity are tight, the task for policy is to build a bridge to the recovery. As economies move through recovery to the expansion phase, the focus naturally turns to sustaining that expansion. That means ensuring that demand continues to be supported for as long as spare capacity remains. Absorbing spare capacity and achieving full employment is an important national priority. Full employment is a worthy goal for its own sake, given how important jobs and income are for people's welfare. It is also a precondition for achieving the rates of wages growth that would be consistent with inflation being sustainably within the 2 to 3% target range that the bank is mandated to achieve. In the context of the post-pandemic recovery, though, there is another reason to support demand that people may not have fully appreciated. And that's to help enable any structural adjustments that might be needed. It is far easier for a firm to change business models when demand is robust. And it's far easier for a worker to switch industries or careers when there are plenty of jobs available. To the extent that the post-pandemic world is indeed different from the pre-pandemic one, a robust recovery and expansion can smooth the transition. And so for all of these reasons, the bank remains committed to maintaining highly supportive monetary conditions. The aim of these policy settings is to support a return to full employment and inflation consistent with the target. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to any questions you might have.
Thanks very much, Lucy. We've got time for questions. Anita has got a microphone there. And John, Anita will hold that and you can just talk into it. That'll be fine.
Thank you for your great presentation. John Seely, we manufacture air conditioning products here in Australia. Regarding outlook for inflation, we're already seeing a lot higher inflation than that in input costs, not only freight, also components, at least 5% on average. What's your outlook for inflation realistically? Because it feels like it's coming quicker than anyone's admitting yet.
Thanks for the question, John. There's no doubt that upstream producer price inflation has picked up, and we're seeing that right around the world. But there's a lot of things that have to be different for that to fully translate into consumer price inflation, which is what we're mandated to achieve and what matters for the welfare of the Australian people. So certainly we have seen that in upstream price pressures, but you're not seeing it yet in retail prices. And even in, so you can see things like, for example, the global price of many things has gone up, many manufacturers' goods has gone up. The landed price of that in Australia hasn't necessarily risen as much. And then there's a whole swathe of domestic costs and margins that are there, you know, are there in between that landed cost and what people actually pay in the shop. So around the world, we are yet to see a material lasting pickup in consumer price inflation. I will remind everybody, though, that when we get to the June quarter CPI, it will look big because the June quarter last year will have dropped out, and that was a big negative because of childcare. There will be these sort of transitory effects as some of the negatives from last year drop out. There have been some localised price pressures around the world, but at the moment, it seems to be mostly upstream, not so much in the sort of retail consumer space. Thanks for that.
Any more questions?
Down the back. Yeah. Sorry. Thanks, Sam. Quick question about the effect of keeping the borders closed. You haven't discussed that, but what's the impact, do you think, on the Australian economy?
Thanks. It's certainly one of the ways that we've been able to limit the number of cases coming in, and so in that respect it's been a key part of pandemic management, and there is no trade-off between managing the pandemic and the economy. The economies that have had a good handle on the pandemic early on have certainly had a smaller contraction and a faster bounce back. But you're right to sort of raise that question, because there is this question about how long that can go on. And so in the forecast we published in May, we had in mind that it would be to around the end of the year, early next year. In the budget, the presumption was mid-next year. So what that does at the moment is the primary thing that it does is it changes services trade. So services exports, particularly education exports, are greatly reduced. Services exports in the form of tourism also came down a lot, basically to zero. There are no tourists coming in, but there are also no Australian tourists going out. And the question is what people are doing with that money. If they're spending that money in Australia instead, it ends up being a net positive, because Australians actually used to spend more on holidays overseas than foreigners spent on tourism over here. So it's not 100% certain what the net on the tourism is, but once you add in the education exports, there is a hit because of the borders being closed. But you do have to then trade that off on the fact that we have been able to open up faster. Having just been through the gamut of getting here from Sydney and not being sure whether I could, and having my little test at the airport and everything, negative. There are going to be some sort of further disruptions, and so I think the real question is how quickly we can vaccinate. And if we're at the end of this year and still quite low vaccination rates, we're going to, it's not a sprint. We may have done really well in the first phase of the pandemic, but there could be countries that had really bad first and second waves of the pandemic who are now opening up because they've got vaccinations, they're moving around, and they'll be the ones who can, engage in business travel, win new business. So there is that question of how long that goes on for, and I would, suggest that, the vaccination rollout is the important part of that.
Lucy, you mentioned about the term funding facility of $200 billion and mm-hmm. also the $200 billion in bonds. Can you explain to a layman explanation of what that actually means to the everyday person on the street and I guess how that encourages the economy?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So taking the term funding facility first, that provided stable, low-cost funding to the banking system, and in particular, banks that increased their lending to businesses and particularly small businesses got more than banks that didn't. And so that was intended to reduce the cost of borrowing, particularly for businesses, but also for households, and ensure that banks had the confidence to continue lending. They knew they had stable funding over that period. Markets have been quite disrupted at various times, particularly in sort of March, April of last year. And so that really lowered the cost of finance and increased the certainty about finance into the economy. In terms of the bond buying program, the primary effect of that is it lowers the yield curve. So it lowers bond yields all the way out. And by buying government bonds, that's the risk-free rate. And so that pulls down everyone else's yields as well, because the risk spreads are priced off the government yield curve. And so that there also contributes to lower funding costs in the economy, a lower exchange rate than we otherwise would have had, which is good for exporters. And so that's really what it does.
Lucy, Alistair Haig from Haig's Chocolates. Is your GDP recovery graph skewed by the iron ore boom and prices? Because I think that the last time iron ore didn't recover like it has. And so to that end, isn't CPI including includes international travel, which is non-existent now? So you're not comparing apples with apples, or are you?
So firstly, to answer the first part of your question, thanks. I mean, I think they're both important points to make. One is those GDP numbers, we strip out prices. It's the real GDP. So when we talk about GDP growth, it's always stripping out the effects of the prices. Absolutely, you know, someone's making a lot of income and a couple of governments are making a lot of tax revenue out of that. But it is the price of the pure price effect does not enter into those numbers. So let me reassure you that that's not skewed. The second point about the CPI and international travel, and I mean, there have been a lot of special factors on the CPI lately. I mean, childcare becoming free, you know, that was just, you know, huge swing in, you know, and then the reversal. So there's been huge swings in headline CPI. What the Bureau of Statistics has done is they've basically inferred, they've attributed a price to that bit of production according to the rest of the CPI. So they've done, I think they, you know, they've done the best you can under the circumstances to get a clean read on underlying prices, and I'm quite content for them to have done that. Over here, we've got a couple.
Last two down the back, I'm conscious of time. David, first.
Thank you, Lucy. The supply chain is a big concern for me. Inflation's one thing, but do you have any comment on the tsunami that's facing us in terms of worldwide shortage of materials, in particular semiconductor chips? We're facing a tsunami that's going to hit us in the fourth quarter of this year and the first quarter of next calendar year. It won't be about inflation. Industry will stop.
Thanks. We're very aware of what's going on in the semiconductor industry. I think that's something we've been watching very closely. I toyed with including this graph, but one thing we know is that the three biggest chip manufacturers, and in particular the ones in Korea and Taiwan, have actually, that they are building new factories as quickly as they can. So it will take a little while. There will be supply constraints, and you will see that in prices. But inevitably, and you know, I gave another speech a couple of years ago called "On Lags," and you know, this is just epitomises that issue of demand goes up, supply can't meet it initially, but it does after a little while, and then prices come back down again. So yeah, that the firms that produce semiconductors absolutely are ramping up their production as quickly as they can, and yeah, in the short run there could be some disruptions, and we are seeing that. And what we seem to be seeing is that oftentimes the firms that then use those semiconductors, particularly in automotive, they're not raising their prices. They're just saying, well, you're going to have to wait 6 months for that car. So you're seeing rationing rather than a price effect, which, again, we're wondering how long that will last.
Last question, Damien.
Oh, thank you, Lucy. Just following on from that question, I guess, COVID's had such a widespread impact. There's been winners and losers. One of the aspects of this pandemic is the relationship with China. Are you seeing the current conditions, or what, do you have any views on how the current conditions with China will play out in the economy?
I don't think I have time to give a comprehensive explanation of that. We have a team in Beijing operating out of our embassy. They are part of our liaison in the same way that our team here in Adelaide is. And so we get a lot of on-the-ground understanding about what's happening. Fundamentally, it has been very difficult for exporters of, you know, particularly agriculture, and you know, particularly where delays can be really, you know, problematic for the value of your exports. You know, if you're selling refrigerated meat or lobster or something, those things are really difficult, and that's something we're keeping a close eye on. But as I mentioned in my speech, the price, you know, in fact, in May, China recorded the biggest ever trade deficit with us, because iron ore, even though they've stopped buying coal from Australia, but the iron ore number is just so huge that, you know, in the end, we're still actually exporting, in value terms, we're exporting more than ever before in total, but it is distributed differently. So there are a lot of complex issues around that. And, you know, again, you know, when the borders do open and students start returning, there's a question about the country composition of that. And, you know, I think it's very hard to predict how exactly that will play out.